antifaz que tu maldad. Welcome to this afternoon's edition of At the Root of It. Recording today and every Tuesday at 4 p.m. at Roberta's Restaurant in Brooklyn. Thank you to our sponsor, Testa Wines, a family-owned business since 1962, responsible for introducing and developing many of the well-known brands in today's wine market, notably Antinori, Ruffino, Vivky Clos. Thank you, Testa Wines. And to our producer and engineer today, Lorenzo Ragioneri and Nat Weiner. We're going to start today's show with a week in wine recap. On Saturday, July 11th, Bulgarian customs officers discovered more than 700 liters of concentrated cocaine solution camouflaged as a shipment of South American wine. The 714 liters of liquid cocaine came to the Black Sea port of Varna, hidden in 1,000 bottles of Bolivian Kohlberg wine in a container sent to Europe from Chile. The rest of the cargo busted in a joint operation with the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency contained real wine, reports said. And yesterday, news broke that the world's largest wine appellation comes into being, and it will be in the U.S. It's the 4-meter-hectare Upper Mississippi River Valley AVA, and it covers over four states. The average AVA, 193 kilometers from east to west, and 362 kilometers from north to south. It encompasses some or all of 10 counties in Minnesota, 9 in Illinois, 18 in Iowa, and 23 in Wisconsin. As one commenter noted, viticulture areas allow vintners to better describe the origin of their wines and to allow consumers to better identify wines they may purchase. At nearly 30,000 square miles, this really broadens the largest sense of the world identity of origin when it comes to wine. And in other news, the current Prosecco di Coglignano e Valbuedini DOC zone will become a DOCG beginning on August the 1st. As reported in Decanter, the name of the new DOCG will be Conigliano Valbuedini, and the sparkling wine will have the words DOCG Superiore on the label as well. Producers making Prosecco from outside the DOCG and DOC region will have to use the new grape name Glera, an ancestor of the Prosecco grape, on their labels instead of Prosecco. This is in a movement to protect the Prosecco name and region as to where it is produced. And a special congratulation goes out to Jim Meehan of PDT in New York, named the American Bartender of the Year at this year's Tales of the Cocktail down in New Orleans, an industry-focused festival of cocktails bringing together the industry's brightest talent. Well done, Jim. Not only does he win America's Best Bartenders, but his bar, PDT, is the world's best cocktail bar. That does it for the Week in Wine Recap, and we'll be right back with our guest this afternoon.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to At the Root of It. That was Little Fella Kuti with Water No Got Enemy. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick recording today at Roberta's, and we're going to place a call this afternoon to Jamie Smith out in Las Vegas. For those of you in the wine trade and for our listeners who don't know Jamie, he's an information wheel, I'd say, receiving, digesting, and redistributing information for the wine enthusiasts all over the world. So I wanted to get him on the phone today to talk a little bit about cork and the carbon footprint of wine, as he is largely charged by environmental issues as well. So we're going to place a quick call to Jamie. Jamie, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Hello, how are you?
Hi, Aaron, how are you doing today?
Good, thanks. Good, how are you?
I'm great. You were just listening to Fella Kuti. His son just put out an album, too.
Oh, yeah? How is it?
One. It's actually pretty good.
Good. So you're a fan.
You know what? Great album covers. That's all I got to say. You ever see the album covers?
Yeah, for sure.
Those are the best.
Well, we're happy to have you on the show today. I wanted to bring up a topic which we've covered in a couple issues. I mean, sorry, segments past about cork. And we've had some disputes or different kinds of judgments as to how they affect the wine in the bottle, how the wine changes with cork, and then also with respect to the environmental aspects of them and whether or not they are a sustainable product. So I wanted to get your input on that. I know you're very opinionated and your opinions have good merit considering as much research and study as you do.
Yeah, I have nothing else to do. I'm a big fan of cork, and there's just one reason for that, and that's because it's natural.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, cork has been around. I mean, Pliny the Elder used to write about cork back at around 2,000 years ago, and we lost the technology until about 300 years ago. Cork is a perfect, sustainable, organic closure for wines. Lets in the right amount of air, lasts for a long time, and it doesn't really... How can I say? I don't want to say poison the wine, but it doesn't
taint.
Add much to this. Yeah, it can, but the reason that it gets tainted is because of people's interference with the corks. If you have clean cork, it can be a very good closure. I think there's a lot of misinformation about how much corked wine is out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a whole other issue about that. As opposed to synthetic things or petrochemical things, the Stelvin closures, the rubber bullets, which are, you know, overtook Italy in the 90s, or the glass closures, which all have some kind of petrochemical ring attached to them. And this non-organic with the organic, really, for me, the wine loses life with
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, there's always the contingencies and the ifs. If you want something that is a perfect closure, Stelvin is great for short-term wine life.
Right.
And I think that when we think about cork and cork's, one of its greatest things is letting the wine evolve to maturity.
Mm-hmm.
So there's very few wines made these days that go beyond 20 years.
Right.
Or, you know, it's just one of those things. It's the nature of the beast right now. Cork for those wines is the perfect enclosure.
Mm-hmm. It was attributed that I read recently that the yearly losses to the wine and cork industry from cork taint, or TCA, are estimated to be about, you know, 685 million pounds. That's in terms of British
English.
British pounds, yeah.
Yeah.
So, which leads into the question of why so many people are moving to these alternative cork closures. And then also, which then affect the environment, given how much cork comes from these forests. So I think that's another interesting topic, which people don't really think about so much, because we need to continue to use these corks in order to sustain some of the livelihood in the environments.
Oh, particularly in Portugal, Lebanon, and Turkey, Anatolia, some of the places that need... or I shouldn't say need, that sustain the industry. And in those countries, there really are sustained plantings. They take care of these places like their national parks. cork takes a long time, a couple of decades, to come into use. I think the English complain a lot about it because they drink a lot of cheap wine. And with cheap wine, you get cheap cork. You know, cork isn't, you know, cork comes in about 9 different grades, from low end to very high end, and from a few pennies a cork upwards to $1 a cork that some of the Grand Crus use. Or I shouldn't say that. Some of the Bordelais use the most expensive corks. You know, they pay the most for it. They get the most processed. If you are processing with hydrogen peroxide, your cork is fine. If you process with bleach or chlorine bleach, and that's where the TCA comes in, that's the trigger for corkiness. That's the thing that sets it off. So a lot of times people are thinking they're going to get great cork, they're going to wash it with bleach, they're going to clean it. Those are low-end, cheaper things. A lot of the high-end, the BOBs and things like that with Tesco and a lot of these low-end wines use the cheap cork. They use cheap cork. They're better off using Stelvins.
Right, right. That makes sense.
Instead of something, yeah, that's inherently, I hate to say crappy, right? But, you get what you pay for most of the time.
Right. Do you think the cork or oak forest could be on a environmental crisis unless we take action to kind of secure their future with respect to continuing cork usage?
Well, I think that cork almost has a resurgence these days away from, but they might be going down in sales as far as corks to the wine industry, but cork is used for insulation, it's used for life jackets, it's used for buoys, it's used for a lot of different things all around the world, and I think that the people in Portugal have no need or want for this industry to go away. Mm-hmm. You know, the use for wine is almost incidental for what the rest of the world uses for cork. So I don't see it going away. They're taking good care of it in a lot of places. You know, as far as great cork is concerned, you know, to add $1 onto each bottle.
Right.
If you that's obviously economically unfeasible for wines that you're trying to bang out at $10 to $15.
What about like Screaming Eagle, who's going cork, away from cork into the screw cap? What's your opinion on that, given your experience as a sommelier and whatnot?
Those wines are made in such an interesting and modern style that 10 years is basically their lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. You know, maybe they'll go 10 years because they do a lot of things that shorten its lifespan and accelerate its lifespan in order to mimic what natural cork can do in the bottle. So if they're playing around and manipulating and getting an instantly ready product when you open it, you take away from its long-term span, so why not use the Stelvin?
Mm-hmm,
right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why not use the Stelvin? If you're going to make something in such a crazy oxidative fashion, the Stelvin works out great, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Grange did those interesting studies with McGill that have been going on since around the mid-60s with Stelvin closures. And I don't know, I've had some of them in the 60s and 70s, and can I say that they're worse or better than cork? I don't know. I think it's really depending on the wine, what it goes into the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Can the cork be beneficial for a great wine? Sure. Can it be hazardous for certain wines? Again, not everybody's making wine to age.
Right.
People aren't keeping cellars for their children anymore.
No, but you have an environmentalist kind of, attitude. It seems that the way you live, the way you live your life is really kind of more in a sustainable conscience. So when you're, I feel like a lot of people don't necessarily think about how that would affect the wildlife, given that it is a more, it's biodegradable, it's natural, it's renewable. That hasn't really come up with respect to the whole movement. So much.
No, I don't think people think about that. I think most people, when they're thinking about wine and they're thinking about closures, are just simply thinking about the economy of their product instead of the sustainability of whether it be the forest or what the forest can sustain, or just, the echo system, if you're not close to it, you can't see it. You're far removed from it. It's almost industrialized food at that point.
Right, that's true. Yeah.
You know, and you know, I had an interesting argument one time with a guy from Spotswood. The owner came in, and he wanted to promote his Stelvin closures. And, you know, when they put those things out, they were $100 more a bottle for the exact same wine.
Really?
There was, yeah, the guy, he got a little heated when pressed to that cause, like, why are you doing this? He didn't really have a good enough answer.
Hmm.
Why is this $100 more? He didn't, you know, didn't really have a good answer for that. And I got to go back and taste some of the wines that had these closures, and I can't say that they're better.
Right, right.
Again, it comes down to the wine that's originally put into the bottle. Would much rather have a cork? Sure.
Yeah, well, it seems like that's the alternative that's more eco-friendly, and now that everyone is also, many places around the world are recycling wine corks, so it takes a more of a conscious decision from the consumer to look into where they can help, you know, with that recycling effort.
You know, working with wine this whole time, though, a lot of people are touting these, whether it's the Germans with the glass stoppers or the Stelvins, these are the wave of the future, and they probably are for cheap wine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
unfortunately.
Cheap wine. Yeah.
For cheap wine, right? Are they recyclable? Most of the tin in there probably could get recycled, but mm-hmm. I think that it gets tossed.
Right.
Unfortunately, you know, depending where you are, a lot of restaurants don't take into that factor.
No, that's very true.
And I'm living out here in the land that doesn't.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back to the next segment and talk about calculating the carbon footprint of wine, another very current topic. Here's Hewete with Testa. Welcome back to At the Root of It. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick. We're here today with Jamie Smith, who's calling in from Las Vegas. You still there, Jamie?
Yes, I am.
All right, great. So we're going to continue today's conversation on the topic of the carbon footprint that we as humans give to wine when we make decisions. Which is very still in a development phase in terms of calculating our carbon footprint. Do you agree with that?
Oh, without a doubt. All comestibles, I would say. And whether that's a choice of where you live or how you live, there's always issues with everything, right? From your clothes to your food.
Right. Yeah, I guess there's a lot of calculations have been studies have been doing recently with respect to traveling food miles and wine miles, but since this is a wine show, we're going to try to concentrate on the wine aspect. And I think that there's a lot of study from the viticulture standpoint where you can look at this. I don't know what your thoughts are on it, but it's certainly a topic of debate.
Oh, yeah. Well, depending where you live makes a big difference on what you're able to get. You live in New York, so you do have some choices for local wines.
Right.
You have the entire state pretty much making wine. So if you're really thinking about it, the most you could do is drink New York wines. Now, if that's what you're going to do, I don't know. But that would make the most sense for choices if you're trying to stay sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
You should stay away from South American wines, because those are obviously the heaviest boots in the mud.
Yeah.
I'm not slagging it.
What do you mean by that? The heaviest boots in the mud?
Well, imagine just making wine anywhere and shipping it from Santiago, where it has to come to New York. All the things involved in that. Even if it's a completely green winery, like we could go to La Postelle.
Right.
They're very proud on all that they do, but it still has to get up here. They use 5,000-pound bottles, which I don't understand. and then it has to come up on a ship. And if you know anything about ships, if they have any garbage, silver oil, anything, it goes right into the ocean.
Right.
They dump everything. It takes a lot of diesel to get from Santiago to New York.
What about the argument? I mean, 90% of the U.S. is wine is concentrated from California. What do you think about, if you're living in New York, the distance traveled from wine from California versus the distance from Bordeaux? I mean, it's 6 hours in either direction, right?
Right. It's basically the same. What comes over land or in the air. And, 90% of what comes from California, again, it's a little misleading because you could say 90% come from California, but I would say 90% of that 90% is bulk wine.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So factory-made, churned-out stuff out in Modesto. Put on a train and chugged out to the East Coast.
But the argument that it's either train or plane versus shipping container. I mean, shipping container...
Crazy people sailing ships across the ocean now with wine on it.
Well, there's plenty of wine that's shipped still from France to New York or from Europe to New York.
By sailboat.
Right.
Yeah, by clipper ships. There's people sailing ships out, clipper ships from the Mediterranean over to New York.
And that is versus a plane or an airplane being shipped wine, it's seemingly more carbon friendly.
Beautiful. Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful way to do it. It's an idealistic world, though, to think
mm-hmm.
about that.
Mm-hmm.
To be on a ship or be on a train, like I said, everything has to move somewhere. Centers of population spring up where they are, and people are going to consume. Can they make better choices? Of course. I think a lot of it starts with the people at the wineries first, making their steps.
By that you mean whether organic practices are being used at the winery.
Well, organic or let's say less pesticidal, because organic is kind of a funny thing to use.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a funny word that doesn't really have much meaning with legislation in our foods. It's kind of almost a dirty buzzword these days.
True.
More natural. Let's say more natural. That's always good.
Okay.
And less pesticides, just so that the soil is renewable, so it doesn't go into groundwater. When it goes into groundwater, it goes into fish. When it goes into fish, it goes into your bodies, and then the entire cycle is passed along. If the wineries start thinking about how they produce, until we get to the point where we have better modes of less combustion traffic, there's really, I don't want to say it's a loss, but it's a funny argument to have.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no other way to do it.
Well, there's been arguments that the number of miles that food travels or that wine travels is is not as critical in determining its carbon footprint, but it's more about whether organic or, let's see, less pesticidal practices are used.
Sustainable, yeah.
Yeah, sustainable.
Yeah. So I would agree, you know, and that's, again, it's a hard thing to measure, but I agree with that, mm-hmm. without a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Without a doubt. You know, it's the old saying my parents always used to say, you know, think globally, act locally. You know, you take care of your own little part of the world.
Yeah. What do you think in terms of biodynamicism with that respect?
You know, I like a lot of it. I think I got to read a lot of Steiner, and I have some friends who practice bio, and you and I were just over in Germany,
mm-hmm.
hanging out with a very interesting guy talking about bio,
you know.
It's a small bit of kooky mysticism, and a lot of really good ideas about how the planet is cyclically, and how we interact with the planet, and how our agrarian sense is lost. My question is, does it make better wine? Does it make better product?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
is it far more carbon positive than modern sustainable viticulture?
Right. Well, it's pretty low on its carbon footprint.
Right.
It's high on man hours.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. And it has yet to prove itself in the flavor category as far as consistency is concerned. You know, my favorite guy, Nicolas Joly, he's mad, he's great to listen to, but there is a tremendous amount of variation, and maybe that's to be expected in biodynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are trying to ride the waves of the planet a little more, and sometimes you wipe out, sometimes you don't. With a product like wine, where really it's liquid art, and, you know, you're ingesting the artwork, your criticism comes into place. And then, you know, I have a friend out here, Rick Moonen, who has a fully sustainable wine list. Him and his sommelier, Jeff, look for these things. They get a tremendous amount of grief from people, because a lot of people don't understand it is about the flavor in the wine, right? But
mm-hmm.
it's more of what the wineries are doing. And I feel better drinking biodynamic wine than I know if it would come from some place, you know, that was just poured on with benzene and different, you know, more crap and more pollution.
Sure.
So I love the idea. I'm just looking for better solutions. This is why sustainable and or organic works a little easier on the flavor profile for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and biodynamic doesn't have to. There are so many restrictions. There are so many restrictions that I don't know. It's difficult to go with that one all the time.
Well, with respect to going back to the measuring the carbon footprint, if we look at the things that happen from a winery perspective in terms of viticulture and shipping, what are some of the things that give our listeners a better understanding of the decisions that are made at a winery, which would thus affect the carbon emissions?
Carbon emissions would be, you know, there's a lot of recycling that can be done at wineries. There's a lot of water wastage,
mm-hmm.
that is done when wineries are not put in the correct areas, and we're trying to force nature.
Right.
With, you know, flood irrigation. So there's a lot of wastewater. You know, the buildings that they make, you know, you've been to wineries. It's better if it's a big cave that's naturally dug in than a billion-dollar building.
Of course, yeah.
You know, even if that billion-dollar building is good, green, and lead, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot better to try to use your natural things around you, you know, as far as waste, as far as what chemicals are concerned or used, as far as packaging. Lighter bottles are obviously better.
Yeah, larger bottles as opposed to half bottles, considering the density of the, you know, comparable volume density to the glass density.
Yeah, half bottles are great in theory, but bad, and really bad in carbon practice, and really bad in longevity for flavors of wine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with wine, the more you have in a bottle, you know, the longer it ages. And it's like an army, a small little army of 375 just doesn't stand up to an army of like 3 liter.
Right.
as far as long, you know, soldiers in a bottle there. You know, there's a lot of things you could do. Packaging, we don't need to wrap wine in paper. What do you need all this fancy paperwork and dead trees around for, right?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like some people have eased up a bit on the styrofoam packaging, which is good. But
styrofoam is a whole nother issue, which is almost it's almost hard to fight because it's such a perfect shipper. Mm-hmm. There are alternatives out there, you know, but working in the wine business and working for a wholesaler, I very rarely saw people reach out to those shipping alternatives. It's always styrofoam.
Hmm.
It gets reused, yeah. You know, a lot, but still it goes in and those things never break down. That's ugly PVCs.
No, for sure. I feel like I've seen a little bit less of it. People using more wood to stack some of the cases, but so we have the packaging, we have the shipping and transportation, we have the fertilizers on the vines, yeah. You know, reducing those. What about the usage of oak versus oak chips?
Ooh, no, that's just a...
I know, it's a frightening thought, I know.
Ooh, it's not only a frightening thought. I'll take it one step beyond nasty. I was at a judging in San Francisco a couple weeks ago, and someone used oak flavoring.
Oh, dear.
Or even resinous powder.
Whew, to give the effect of oak?
To give the effect of oak on a let's go, how can we do this on the cheap scale?
Wow.
And wow, you know, it's just a horrible, horrible thing. At least oak barrels are reusable.
True.
At least for, you know, a couple
years.
Decades.
Yeah.
Well, a couple decades if you're trying not to get flavor, but, you know, a lot of the forests around the world are always constantly being replanted. And, you know, the places that these places that take care of it, a lot in France and in Georgia and different places, they have been doing this for hundreds of years. They think of it as a sustainable and a finite business. So they're always constantly replanting, always taking care of things. And except for a few ugly years around the world wars, France has been pretty good around it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and diversity and things like that help with the natural cycle of all of the plants that they're trying to cultivate, not just the oak trees.
No, for sure. Well, it's certainly a topic that can go on for many many years in terms of deciphering, what the actual calculated carbon footprint of wine is. But in the meantime, I think that there's much conversation that should be given and attention given so that our conscience is a little bit more clean or green when we go in and buy our wine. I have to say, though, I don't know that I would stop buying French wine. I'd rather stop buying a bottled water every day. You know, if that
stay away from bottled water.
Right.
Stay away from bottled water. You got the best water in the world in New York. Drink it.
Yeah, well, exactly. But, you know, it's one of those conveniences you just grab. But if I could choose one thing or the other, just so that I was knowing I was doing a small part, I would definitely forego the bottled water. Well, we'd love to have you on the show again sometime to discuss another topic. I'm sure that there's, as I mentioned, you are a wealth of knowledge, and you do teach over at UNLV as well, yeah?
Yeah, still. I've been a professor there for 11 years.
And what are you teaching?
Each semester we flop back and forth. There's a couple of us. Domestic wine it's New World versus Old World. So
it's a curriculum that's labeled New World versus Old World?
Right. It's a 300-level class. It's a required class for a beverage degree. UNLV and Cornell have beverage degrees. So it can, you know, it's a pretty good class, I think. Teach you about, you know, about technology versus non-technology. And the lines between old and new are so blurred, it's hard to tell anymore.
Right. It's very true.
So hard to tell.
Well, before we close, would you like to also mention your website that you you started? I know you do a lot of blasts to people all over the world with respect to news and information, but you're also working on another project as well.
Yeah, but it's not ready to go out to the world yet. We're still trying to flesh it out. But it's coming.
Okay.
It's coming. I could give you the name. You know, it's called Eniverse. It's with a good friend of mine, Jay James. And one of these days, it'll get going.
Is that also the domain as well?
It is the domain name.
Yeah.
We do own that name. Well, there's another guy, too, a programmer. His name's Anton. And whether it's up and running, might just have a static page on there right now.
Got it.
But
okay.
Things
so
coming,
we'll
you know.
Hold out for that.
Yeah, to take over the world.
Well, thanks so much for your time today. It's a pleasure having
you
on.
All
and
right,
we'll speak with you soon.
And take it easy.
Thanks, you too.
Bye.
And bye-bye. And a thank you to our sponsor, Testa Wines, as well. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick at The Root of It at Roberta's in Brooklyn. See you next week, 4 p.m. Tuesday.